Hello there, and welcome to the podcast. It's John Markar here, and I thought I'd just jump in with a very quick but very important message that I wanted to share with you before you delve into this episode of the Driven Chat podcast. This podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now come to an end. But don't worry, I'm not going to stop you from listening to this episode or from catching up with the 185 episodes that we've recorded in this format. I just wanted to let you know that if you're looking for our new episodes recorded after December 2023, then you'll need to seek out our new podcast, The Driven Podcast. You can find The Driven Podcast in all the usual podcast platforms, including, chances are, the one that you're listening to this one on right now. So please do enjoy this episode, share it with a friend by all means. But when it's done, don't forget to search for the new podcast, The Driven Podcast, and subscribe to the new format to hear the new stuff. To make life easy, head on over to the Driven website via driven.site. There you will find links through to the new podcast, including links to your preferred podcast platform. And hey, whilst you're there, why not check out everything else we do, including hand-picked automotive news stories, car and bike reviews, video features, and even more. For now, though, I'll let you enjoy this episode, and I will remind you again at the end of the episode, but for the future reference, this message is approximately 1 minute and 30 seconds long. That's 6 clicks on the 15-second skip button. Enjoy!
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's Driven Chat podcast. My name is John Markar and sat to my left is Amy Shaw.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm all right. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good. I've got a cup of tea, holding a cup of tea, feeling quite comforted.
Yeah. Well, we're in our home from home, in a homely bedroom at Caffeine & Machine, which sounds a bit weird when you say it like that, doesn't it?
It did sound a bit odd.
I'm actually sat on a bed, would you believe? I'm sat on a bed in one of our bedrooms. Usually we use our studio truck on the grounds here at Caffeine & Machine, but in the winter months, with it being dark and cold, it's all a bit of a faff. So we've taken the lazy option and we are here in a bedroom. But fear not, dear listener, myself and Amy are not alone in this bedroom. It's getting weirder, actually, the more I think about it.
I'm spilling my tea.
And Amy's spilling her tea. It's chaotic.
It's gone wrong.
It's all gone wrong. And we're only, well, I don't know, less than a minute into the recording. But there we are. Amy, I'd like to hand over the introduction reins to you because okay. I mean, this is your guest.
Yes.
Your invite. So therefore, it's only right that I pass on the introduction baton to you.
Well, thank you. Well, I mean, it's always funny introducing somebody because if you're listening to this, you've probably had to read something on a screen to be able to get to this listening point. And in that case, you already know who our guest is. But to give an overall, I mean, he looks like a rock star and has done for most of his journalism time. You have done. When you had a little bit longer hair, you did look like you could have walked out like the Arty Monkeys or something like that.
No, a little homeless shelter, otherwise. One of the two, isn't it? I've always close thought, thing.
Well, I mean, I've always thought about more the rock and roll vibe, but that is the lovely voice of Mr. David Lillywhite, who, for those of you who do not know, is the co-founder of Octane Magazine and Autoclassics.com, making sure I've got that written down right, and more recently, Magneto Magazine. Welcome, David.
Hey. Hello, thank you.
It's funny, like, when you read, even that's just like skimming the surface of kind of your career, because I know you've done many exciting things, worked for Bike Magazine, I'm going to say.
Yeah,
that was it. And is it called Bike Magazine or just Bike?
I think you have to say Bike Magazine, don't you?
Yeah, so Octane was always Octane Magazine, but it's like, it's Octane, it's just that. But not many people have got on their CV that they've started one silly successful magazine, let alone two silly successful magazines and a silly successful website. So if we were to roll right back to the beginning, maybe not to the beginning of like, so you were born in whenever you were born, but kind of let's think about the beginning of Octane, because that is what, you know, when I first got into car photography, I had no idea, you know, I didn't particularly like cars or classic cars. Even. Oh, you know, kind of like them. But the thing that got me into thinking, right, who the hell am I going to go and speak to about photographing for, I don't know, a classic car magazine? I looked on the shelf at Sainsbury's and I thought, huh, that one looks like my kind of magazine. It looks cool. Looks like it's got good photography. And it was Octane magazine. You've got the ability to be interesting to people who are not interested in cars. So that, as far as my research has gone, started as a conversation at a pub.
Of course.
As all the best
things do. Yeah, come on, let's be honest.
So you were with your co-founder, Jeff Love. Were you friends at that point? Or did you just happen to meet in a pub and have a few pints in and be like, hey, you like cars, I like cars, we like to write, let's start a magazine.
Yeah, I don't think he'd mind if I said I don't think we were friends at the time, but we'd been colleagues at EMAP, and we'd done a little bit when I was freelance. I think he tried to get me doing a bit on Practical Classics at the time, which I'd been on years before. And then, yeah, we got pulled into a meeting for a magazine called Practical Performance Car that's still around. And the guys doing that wanted to know if Jeff and I wanted to be involved with it. And we kind of talked it through and we left them to it, but walked out of the pub going, so what, you want to do a magazine? Yeah, what, you want to do a magazine? And so we went to the next pub down the road, obviously, and we talked it through. And Jeff had really thought it through, but he said, where do you think the gap is? And I said, well, it's got to be an interesting magazine at the top end of classic cars because everything's got so boring. And, you know, people into classic cars are usually quite interesting, but all the magazines were just really, really dull. So that was kind of the background. And he'd already thought it through and thought Robert Kucher and Sanjay Sitanar would be really good sort of co-partners in this. And then, it goes on and on, this story, so I won't bore you to death.
And what year is this, just out of interest?
This is 2002 when we started talking, late 2002. And I was just... Well, Jeff had just got married. I was just getting married. I was just moved house. Every little bit of stress you can possibly put in is like, right, we'll do that one. Oh, a new business. Brilliant. So we went looking for backing. And we went through venture capital people. We went through sort of enthusiasts who we knew, big car collectors. And we'd say, all right, well, let's get eight of you and each put in a chunk of money. And then we get to sort of six or seven of them and want to drop off the other end, and you never quite got there. And venture capital people wanted arms, legs, place on the board. Well, we didn't want a board. So it was all a bit like, we don't know if this is going to happen. And then Sanjay met a friend who was friends with Simon Jordan, who was at the time chairman of Crystal Palace Football Club. Made lots of money in mobile phones, really into cars, and looking to do a sort of personal Dragon's Den kind of thing. So we went to Crystal Palace and we had a meeting with him, and it was quite disturbing because I was a Watford supporter, so I didn't want to go anywhere near Crystal Palace. But he was quite aggressive, but he was the one who said, all right, yeah, I believe in you guys, gave us a chunk of money, and we were kind of off, and we launched early May 2003. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty rapid. And we were quite optimistic and put huge amounts of copies into WH Smith's and all the different shops, and most of them came back. But actually, it did get a really good foothold right from the start. Mm. And that was the start of Octane. So yeah, 2003.
That must have been quite a... I'm trying to get my head around the timescales, because of course back in 2003, the internet ultimately for the masses is still in its infancy, really, isn't it? It's although you know a lot of people, if they were very lucky, they might have had the internet at home in the late 90s, early noughties. Suddenly, the internet really started booming. At that point, if you cast your memory back, was there any thought at all that magazines in printed form might be entering a I don't want to say like a difficult chapter or a final chapter, but of course it's no secret now, is it, that print media is a dying luxury, really, for a lot of the big publishing companies. At that point, was there any inclination that might even be a factor to consider in the next 10 years or so?
I'm trying to remember, but I'm pretty sure. I remember while I was still employed at EMAP, which was up until about 2000 before I went freelance, there was lots of talk of how we mix print with an internet product.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And, you know, how we sort of... There was talk of changing the whole dynamic. I'm thinking, I'm not sure how this is going to work. Mm. But I do remember those phrases, and I do remember those meetings, trying to work out how you get classic cars and modern cars onto the internet and make it work for people and still have a print magazine. Mm. And I think at the same time, Q magazine, which I used to read a lot, I'm pretty sure at the time they took their pagination right back and put all their reviews on the internet around that time, and the print magazine just turned into something half its size.
Wow.
Because then you decided to, how many years was it from starting Octane to starting the website autoclassics.com?
I left Octane after, I think it was 171 issues, which is more than enough for anybody. Somebody else does it now.
You end up, you don't judge time in terms of years. Oh, it's God, it's no. Issues now.
Yeah, totally. Which was August 2017 I left. So I do know, really. Yeah. 14 years.
So, I mean, in that time, did you think to yourself, okay, at some point, as John was saying, we're going to have to relook at maybe printed magazines and move something over to an online platform? Because what I'm interested, especially, is the way that you did go from print to online, which is, you know, expected, but then you've now gone from online back to print. And to be able to go from, you know, when you started Octane, you said, you know, you had to find where the, not necessarily the gap in the market, or how can we be different from all of these other, you know, magazines which are boring. Now, in this day and age, sorry, maybe you didn't say that exactly.
I did.
But the thing is now, in Magnuto, started in, 2018.
Yeah, I had to think about that.
Well, I mean, by this point, you know, internet is well and truly there with many, many interesting places that you can look at car reviews, classic cars, all this stuff. But, you know, YouTube, not even think about the video side. What made you think, you know what, let's go back to print? And how did you think, you know, we can be different, or we can still sell our product by doing it this way? What that must have been, I mean, from my point of view, that sounds quite scary. But what was the thought process for that?
I think it was the internet, really, that made Magnuto. Because digital had scared a lot of publishers. So they downgraded, a bit like we're talking about Q magazine all those years back. In more recent years, loads and loads of publishers have downgraded their print because they think, well, the internet's going to get bigger and bigger, digital's going to get bigger and bigger, so no one's going to want print. So we'll preempt that and we'll downgrade the paper stock, we'll cut budgets, and so fewer people buy the products, and the publishers go, see, I told you. And you think, well, actually, is that not because the product's not good enough? And also, there's this complete digital onslaught. You can find anything, but you've got to look for it. So if you serve up something, a print product that's curated, that's got surprises in, or that's just got something that's not that surprising but is more in depth than you could find anywhere else, and that you can sit back and enjoy, then I think that's one step of it. Then you've got a lot of magazines out there still. I mean, despite everything we're saying about, you know, print supposedly being dead, completely. There are so many magazines. They're coming out weekly, monthly, etc. And I think they're turning up on people's doorsteps, and they're wrapped in the cellophane, and they stay wrapped in the cellophane because, again, it's too much. You've got all the digital, you've got monthly magazines. So the whole idea of Magnuto, it's kind of a bit of quality time, really. It's that slow thinking thing where you do finally sit back, you appreciate the quality of it and the paper. The photography looks much better. It's nicer to read because the print stands out on the decent paper. It's not sunk into a cheap paper. And you've got a bit of relaxation. Mm-hmm. And if it looks right, then, okay, it looks good on the coffee table. It's a terrible thing, but it does. And it looks good on the shelf, and you don't throw it away. And even unwrapping it is an experience because it turns up in a nice cardboard wrap instead of cellophane. So that was the thinking. And I think without all the digital onslaught, I will say it again, although it's a brilliant thing, I don't think Magnuto would have happened.
Is there any plans to kind of expand an online version of Magnuto? Are you going to keep it print and quarterly for kind of the near future?
We have a website, and there are probably up to 10 stories a week on it, and a fair bit of social media. It's not, you know, it's not throwing ourselves at people. It's fairly subtle, but just so people can keep abreast of what's happening. So it's, you know, interesting sales, it's new events, how events went, winners at Pebble Beach, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And we've got a weekly newsletter, email newsletter, and that works really, really well. And a lot of people really seem to appreciate that. Mm-hmm. So that's the digital side. I don't think we'd go much further than that. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, you don't want to saturate people. You don't want to, them to think, oh, no, not more Magneto.
I don't want any more.
Yeah, no more Lily White.
Well, I mean, this is something, I suppose, which I'm finding interesting is your thought process behind printed magazines as well, because there must be so many people do try, as you said, to start a magazine. Like even this week I've heard about a great magazine that's had to stop printing because, you know, there's just been not enough, you know, being sold. So when it comes to the formula, which you must, maybe you've got a secret formula that works on how to make a successful printed car magazine. What would you say are some of the key elements of that?
Get it into the hands of the right people.
Okay, so not about wide distribution through all the WH Smiths around the UK.
No. as bizarre as it seems, I mean, you can do that, but the retailers are going to take 50%. You're going to have to put lots and lots of copies out, half of which will probably remain unsold, or they might do, just because you can't risk them going out of stock. So you may well end up with two copies, one copy, whatever, in every single shop being thrown away. And that's a huge waste.
Yeah.
So there's actually not very much profit in magazines on shelves. So the decent model is subscription, which of course all magazines try and push people into, but there is a reason for that. It does, you know, it does keep magazines going. It is really important. But what we've also done is made sure it gets to, for example, anyone who's entered a car into Pebble Beach or Amelia Island, Concours, or Concours of Elegance, Hampton Court, any one of those big events or a lot of historic racing events, they will all receive a copy. So then advertisers know that they are advertising their car to people who are buying cars. They're not just buying magazines off the shelves in WH Smith, Tesco, etc. They are buying cars.
Yeah.
And then anything else on top of that is a bonus for us.
I suppose it's the obvious way of looking about it, because some people think, okay, maybe I need to find the best stories of the best cars with the best writers on the, you know, best quality. And it's not necessarily about any of that. It's just making sure that at the end point, you've got it in the people's hands who are going to be the most valuable to you guys as the magazine and the advertisers and everybody who wants to read it.
I think they wouldn't bother with it. They would throw it away if it didn't have good stories in, if it didn't look good, etc. So obviously I'm going to say, no, these are the best stories and the best cars as well. And we try really hard to get the very best stories out there.
Yeah. When it came to thinking about the first, the very first issue of, you know, let's go with Octane first. When it came to the very first issue of Octane, what was the thought process to try and make, because obviously the first thing you see is the front cover. Mm. When you're trying to go against everybody who is already on the shelves, and you know, people who like those classic car magazines, they like them for a reason. They're like, yeah, well, you know, that is all the technical geekery that I want to read, and I'm not bothered about who, I don't know, whatever story is behind it. Or they may not think they are until you're like, actually, no, there's a massive amount of people who would love to read about this. When you're trying to battle that whole range initially, what was the thing that you put on the cover or the stories that you put inside to try and grab people's attention? Because I guess that was, you've got maybe one issue to really go for it, maybe a second issue, but how many issues would you have to go into before you're thinking, actually, this isn't working very well?
To answer that last bit, most new magazines, 3 issues in is the real danger point.
Really?
Because then the printers are saying, no, we need you to pay. The advertisers still aren't paying. You know, we weren't getting money in from advertisers or from the likes of WH Smiths for 90 days. So by that point, you've done 3 issues. You've had to pay your print and paper. You've had to pay contributors. But you're not getting any money back at all. So as soon as cash flow has stopped like that and you've run through that startup money, then you say goodbye to your magazine.
Wow. Is that the same for quarterlies and monthlies, or is it harder with monthlies?
I guess quarterlies is easier in that you've got that amount of time to collect some money. Mm. But you're never going to get rich on a quarterly because it's only four times a year. You know, of course. It's very irregular.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we got to 3 months and we were doing all right. The advertising was selling really well. It was getting a good reception. But we hadn't had any money back. Overseas magazine sales, you don't get paid for 6 months. Right. And we had really targeted overseas. Mm-hmm. So our cash flow was terrible. And we were just on the point of running out of money, in that we were sort of almost scraping together savings to pay the few staff we had.
Wow.
And then, it just began to take off and the money started coming in from advertising and it's like, oh, we've done it. So it was a bit fraught.
Yeah.
And the start of the question, the Octane first issue, you have to bear in mind at the time that the sort of competitor magazines had gone very mid-market and mass market, and rightly so, but there was nothing at the top end, and the top end of the market was really taking off, and there were more and more auction houses and more really top-end dealers. So we went straight in with a Ferrari 250 GTO versus Bizzarini. and just the fact that we could get those cars together, that kind of made the statement. And we went on from there with those kind of things, GT40, stuff like that.
Amazing. I guess one of the questions that I often think about with print media, and this only really comes because the majority of my career in the automotive world has been very much focused around the internet. And of course, the internet provides this wonderful tool, which is analytics. And you can see within 24 hours of putting up a written article or a video or a social media post, you can see what performs well, what doesn't, which demographics enjoy it most, at what time of the day it tends to go down well. Now, of course, with print media, you do your research for your story, you write your story, you take your amazing pictures, it goes to print, it goes off. Was there any ever, or is there any ever, analytical route you can go down to know what's gone down really, really well? With print media, is that a thing? How does it work?
You can to a point, but it's very slow.
Yeah.
So you get all the point of sale data. It's not very exciting, so I'll leave that for Jeff. He likes it. and yeah, you can see which stores are selling, which areas, which countries. Mm-hmm. But of course, you might have been up against certainly with Octane, you might have been up against a heavily promoted copy of Classic and sports car.
Yeah.
So your sales were low and you think, oh, so I shouldn't have put those cars on the cover. Mm. And actually it might have just been something else entirely. And then there was a time at Dennis Publishing who bought Octane after 4 or 5 years. And they had a new newsstand director there and we'd got a McLaren F1 on the cover. And it sold 20% more copies than the previous few issues. Wow. And he said, for one, he said, well, can you do any more McLaren F1 covers? tricky. And then he showed us some of the figures and I said, well, aren't those figures 20% higher? You know, you put out 20% more copy and it sold 20% more. So, yeah. Wow. And they just wouldn't accept that.
There you go. All business entrepreneurs out there, if you want to sell 20% more, produce 20% more stock. And it's faultless. Yeah, that is. I do like the idea of somebody just saying, and I think there'll be a lot of people, especially in our industry, that are listening to this in all aspects, both digital and print media, and even events, even that have had a big boss or a decision maker somewhere going, hey, that worked really well. Just do that again. And the idea of just printing magazines with F1s on the cover, I'd love it personally. But not quite how it works, really, is it?
Tempting, though, isn't it?
It is tempting. Yeah, it is tempting.
I find something similar in, when I put on like an Instagram post of something. It's like if I only ever put photographs of usually red Ferraris. It's usually a red classic sports car.
It's amazing.
No, I get loads of likes and stuff, and I think to myself, but it's not really. I mean, maybe you could make a full Instagram page just of red sports cars. I don't know.
One of my favourite Instagram accounts on this subject is Make Green Great Again. If you've seen this one. It is 100% photos of green cars. It's absolutely brilliant. I don't know who runs it. I have a feeling it's a friend of a friend. I think I know who it is. But it's just incredible because it is just green cars.
So maybe sports cars or normal cars?
Anything. Hmm. Anything. Literally a brand new Porsche GT3s in oak green. Obviously best colour ever. to through to old Lamborghini Muras in green. It's just everything's green. Make green great again.
I don't think I want to make red great again because what was it? It's the most popular car color in the 90s, I think, and I don't think I'm quite ready to see it again. Like another like red E-Type, I'd be a bit fed up with, to be honest.
That's just a very first world problem. Oh, I see too many red E-types. How many times a week do you hear that sentence?
You kind of forget my second job.
Yes, true.
Although, funnily enough, we haven't got a red one at the minute.
Oh, well.
Well, it's been shop blasted, so now it's grey.
So. Perfect. Well, if you have a red E-type and you'd like to really bother Amy, then send it in.
Please, we can do colour changes.
So, David, let's go back to... I always like to delve into the beginnings, really, of how people end up in this wonderful industry that we're all in, whether that's as a writer, as a photographer, as a event person, however it may be. Where did it all start for you? And ultimately, how did you end up deciding that it was better to go things your own way, ultimately?
Is this where I said, well, I was born in? no, but it was obviously the childhood thing. It always is, isn't it?
Yeah.
My dad was really into cars. We had a fairly ramshackle garage, and garage at home. And there was an inspection pit in the garage.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of dad's friends came around with like MGBs and Healy Sprites and things like that. So there was that when I was really, really young. My dad was quite into cars. He took me to VSCC, Vintage Sports Car Club, racing at Silverstone, I remember. My granddad was into cars. In fact, both were. My uncle Phil, who's my mum's brother, he was massively into cars. He'd have a new performance car every single year. He'd have Capri 2.8i, he had a Lotus Carlton, he had all sorts of stuff.
We have an Uncle Phil like that too, don't we, John?
Really? We do, actually, yeah, we do. Yeah.
So, yeah, thank you very much, Uncle Phil.
Yeah, we like Uncle Phil.
Yeah, he was very good for that. Then my stepdad was into cars. It was just, a disease, really. It was a terrible thing. And my dad bought me a Honda C50 step-through moped type thing when I was about 11, I think, just to start playing around with it and work out how engines worked. And then I just kept buying things with pocket money and paper round money. So I'd had a whole fleet of Honda step-throughs. It was just never-ending. It's disastrous, really, for my parents.
The Driven Chat Podcast in association with Paramex Digital.
I think I read somewhere that your parents said, there's no money in classic cars or in cars. You should probably go and do something else.
Actually, it was I think they probably said that because I wanted to be a motorcycle mechanic. So I left school at 15, which sounds like I was born in the Middle Ages or something. But because my birthday's in August, I was actually 15 when I left school. And I don't think anyone even noticed at school. So I did all right in my exams and I just sort of drifted away. Wanted to do a course on motorcycle mechanics, did a little bit during the summer and thought, maybe not for me. And then an apprenticeship came up at Marconi, so I became a Marconi apprentice. But just before that, I spoke to a careers teacher and
they're full of wisdom here.
Yeah. He said, well, if that's your hobby, do not go into cars or bikes. So, yeah, that was it.
But why? What was her reasoning for that?
It would ruin the hobby.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
And I think there is something in that.
Yeah, no, I agree. Photography is technically still my hobby, but there's been definitely times where I've had to not take any pictures because I'm just done. But there's, I suppose, the funny thing about, we're in this room, we're all passionate about cars and bikes, but we all work with cars and bikes.
Yeah.
So how have we not lost the interest? Or have you in the past, especially doing the magazines, have you ever lost the interest and just think, I just want to get away from automotive things for a while?
I think I've had times where I didn't need to go to any more car shows. every weekend and you're manning a stand at a car show. But actually then go to a show that's just a little bit out of what I normally do, say Santa Pod Dragstalgia or something like that with my friends, where nobody's going to come and say, can we do this on Octane, Magneto, Classic Cars, or wherever I was at the time.
Yeah, you must have a lot of people saying, oh, you know a great story, this.
Yeah, which is brilliant. It's how it works, really. Mm-hmm. But, it does mean you can't do the off-duty thing. And I don't mean that does sound like the worst first world problem moan ever, and it's not at all. It's brilliant. But just every now and again to go to a show where I don't have to be looking for features too much and I can relax.
Yeah.
That's brilliant and I absolutely love it.
That's always been, the show aspect has always been the bit that I've always struggled with the most. Because again, like that famous careers, careers advice said, if that's your hobby, don't do it as a job. I've heard both sides of it because of course there's that lovely saying, isn't there? If you find a job in an area that you love, you'll never work a day in your life or whichever, however it's worded by whoever's quoting it. And I kind of swing either side of that argument because there are times where I've definitely thought, especially back on my, when I was mainly hosting events and running car events and exactly that, going to events like Le Mans Classic with a group of people where you're looking after a group and you're hosting effectively, the amount of times where I'd stand in a gazebo or I'd just get a tiny glimpse of a track while somebody's telling me about their Delahaye and I'm pretending to be interested. I often did think, God, why didn't I go into horse events or something I have no interest in at all? Because then I wouldn't mind standing in this gazebo and talking to somebody about their horse or whatever you drive horses in. Yeah, as you can tell, my equine knowledge is peak. And for me, that was always it. It was the event aspect. But then there are so many other parts of the job that far outweigh that, where I find myself surrounded with beautiful cars and amazing people and fascinating environments, where I think, God, if I wasn't doing this as a job, there'd be no way I'd be here, sat in one of the passenger seats of an F1 or overlooking the hairpin on the top of the Fairmont Hotel in Monaco. There definitely swings roundabouts to it. I don't know what you guys think, but my advice to anyone, if they've had that same comment from somebody saying, if you work in a cake shop, you'll get sick and tired of cakes, so don't work in cars if you love cars. Nonsense, I think, because you will always find your route into it. The car world, as we've said, this is probably the most quoted thing I've ever said on this podcast, but the car world is pretty much solely occupied by people who have a passion for cars. It is a passion-led industry. We are all in it because we love cars. And cars are this bizarre, unnecessary accessory to our lives, really, because, of course, we all know we could all be driving around in Nissan Micras or Vauxhall Corsas, but we choose not to, because there are better things, more exciting things, and more fascinating things for us to do. And because of that and that reality, it will always be interesting. So yeah, I'd hope that anyone listening who's at that perhaps interesting time of their lives, they're going, what am I going to do? Maybe that's not such a good idea.
What advice would you give people who are listening, youngsters that are listening, or not even youngsters, people who think, I am bored with my 9 to 5 and I think I fancy starting a car magazine? What advice would you give them?
It'd be really flippant to say, don't do it.
Because you've now done it multiple times.
But I don't mean it, because actually I can't imagine having done anything else. I've met the most amazing people, been to the most amazing places. Nobody will have had any sympathy with us moaning about going to car events.
Correct.
And rightly so.
Yeah.
What do? Well, you go for it, but you work out a plan and you get to know as many people as possible and you badger people and you just look into what you want to do and why you want to do it. All you can do is just keep badgering people, really, and make as many contacts as possible. And I think people like me, generally, we might be busy, but we're always really keen to help bring more people in.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a friend who I was talking to on email last night, or rather I was talking to his son on email last night, because he wants to get into car journalism. He wasn't sure which A-levels to take, so we're just back and forwards on that. And it's really encouraging that people still want to do that.
I suppose that's the other thing. I do worry that the passion for cars, especially classic cars, will be dying as the generations kind of come along, because you hear about kids now that don't want to get taken to prom in a lovely, I don't know, classic anything. They want to get taken to their prom in a Tesla. And you just think, but why? And it does concern me that this wonderful car world that we're in will end up kind of fizzling out when we all, kick the bucket or, have a too enthusiastic day on a racetrack.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I think there will definitely be periods of cars that become less appealing. I often think about pre-war. I have a bit of an unhealthy obsession with pre-war cars, but only up to a certain point. So if we're talking about Bentleys, Delahayes, that sort of thing from the 1920s and 30s, that really gets me excited. But anything prior to that, early 1900s, that's not a car, as far as I'm concerned. It's got horse cart wheels. It goes... It has steam coming out of it. No interest to me whatsoever. So I think there will be as time goes on, I think the main separation I always find is that it's something that's unrecognisable as a car. And for me, that's what kind of turns me away. But now I know there will be people that will look at a 1927 Blower Bentley and go, but that doesn't look like a car to me either, because I have to change gear by scratching my ankle and the handbrake's on the outside and my passenger has to lube my suspension with his foot. All of these things are true. And I think as time goes on, people will kind of lose track of that chapter. But I'd like to think, perhaps slightly misty-eyed, that certainly cars that are recognisable, certainly from the, say, 50s onwards, 60s and 70s were fantastic eras for cars. I think there will always be people of all ages and even generations beyond us that will look back on those favourably, because they will always be recognised as cars, as things that they can get in and drive. And all the pedals are the same and the gear sticks the same. I hope, anyway.
Yeah,
I really do.
I hope as well. And I imagine it will do. But I mean, talking about, you know, cars generally in your favourite eras, you've had quite a few cars, Mr. Lillywhite. how many roughly do you think you've owned?
It's about 50.
That's pretty good.
And I say this figure, and then I think that can't be right. So I write it down, and I have got a list at home that I update every now and again. And it is, and some of them, all of them have been terrible. I don't really own really good cars, and when I get a car to a point where it's really good, I usually sell it because I don't know what to do with it after that.
Yeah.
So often if I'm meant to be going to a really nice event, I don't have anything to go in because I've taken my nice car apart again, and it's just what happens, isn't it? So I've cut right back, but I have had about 50.
Okay. What are some of your most memorable, not necessarily your favourites, your most memorable cars of that 50?
Well, actually, probably the most memorable and my favourite was a Triumph Herald.
Cool.
Okay.
And I'd had a whole load of Mark 1 and 2 Escorts right through college and things. I did electronics degree with Marconi, and then everything started falling apart at Marconi, and I started thinking about another job. And just at that point, my Mark 1 Escort with a 2-litre engine in that I'd built and spent all my student grant and all my sponsorship on it was stolen.
Oh, no.
And about 2 weeks before it was stolen, I got done by the police for sliding around a roundabout and got points. So my insurance was suddenly, well, basically I was almost uninsurable. Yeah. So I found this Triumph Herald for sale, and it had never been messed with. It was a bit scruffy. And I thought, well, that will do. And that got me reading classic and sports car, and particularly practical classics. So then when Marconi started falling apart, and it looked like I was going to lose my job, which I'd only had there postgraduate for about 6 months anyway, I just wrote to all these magazines, and Practical Classics wrote straight back and said, Vicky Butler Henderson has just moved to Max Power. So that kind of dates things. come for an interview, and I got the job.
No way.
So I've just gone off on a massive tangent, but that's one of the reasons why my Triumph Herald is my favourite car, because it kind of helped change my life.
Do you still have it?
No.
Why?
To buy my daughter a pram.
Oh, really? Wow.
There's so much money in publishing.
Yeah, that's the one. Whenever we've had that kind of, what would be your advice be? It's fascinating talking to different people in different fields of the automotive world, but certainly from the journalism background, the one common theme when it comes to advice is, please don't expect to ever be.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Be a millionaire in this career, because you won't. You won't. You do this because you like writing about cars and because that's good fun. I want to get on to the early stages of your journalism career, because that's definitely something that's going to be fascinating for a lot of people. But I can't skip forward past the cars bit yet, because that is a crucial one. I won't ask you to list them all, but certainly you mentioned it, and I'm sure this is something that so many people listening to are going to be able to relate to and go, yeah, I've done that. And that is the whole fix the car up to a point where it's perfect and then get rid of it, which makes no sense really when you think about it. But we've all done it time and time and time again. I've done it more times than I can count. What are those cars? Not necessarily because they're potentially worth a lot of money now, but that's always a fun little recap. What are those cars that you really miss or wish you hadn't sold?
Yeah, I wish I hadn't sold the Herald, obviously.
Is it still on the road? Could you find it?
No. A few weeks after I sold it, the guy who worked in a prison and had some of the prisoners work on the car, the brakes failed and he smashed it to pieces. I'm not sure if those facts are related at all.
Oh, wow. But yeah, what a story, though.
It. Yeah. So it's gone, I'm afraid.
Oh. I'm sorry for your loss. Yeah.
So, thank you very much.
So yeah, I pushed it into you. What other things would you...
Citroen SM. Because that was one of those really stupid things to have done. Buying a $1,500 Citroen SM from New York, unseen, shipping it over, driving it, possibly not all that legally, from Felixstowe docks. You might have to cut that bit out, obviously.
It was a long time ago, it's fine.
Yeah, exactly, it'll be fine. And then restoring it, right, sort of stripped it right back. Wow. With help from a guy who's since died, sadly, Andrew Brody, who was the Citroen SM man. Mm. And we got it to a point where it was stunning. And I got to a point where I felt I couldn't take it any further. So I sold it to a big collector who's put quite a bit more money into it and has made a really great job of it. But it was the most amazing experience to just work out how everything worked, Maserati engine and Citroen hydraulics and crazy, crazy sort of low volume engineering. That was a brilliant thing to have. And I drove it around a bit and I did feel slightly like I was driving a grenade with a pin pulled out. But actually, it's a much, much easier car to work on than people think. It's far more reliable and far, far better than anyone would ever think. It's just they weren't treated very well at the time. So that was one. Porsche 914, which again I bought unseen from the States and which never really ran that well with me because I ripped off the ignition up at Weber's on it and just messed around with it and it looked amazing. It was lowered, it had Mahler wheels, it just looked really spot on. But we had all manner of adventures. We went to Le Mans in it and broke down on the way to Le Mans and I had a little temper tantrum, which I never do. I never lose my temper at anything. I lost my temper at this car. Wanted to leave it there. And my friend Matt Howell persuaded me that actually we could fix it, and we did. So our big convoy sat there on the hard shoulder while he helped me fix it. And off we went to Le Mans, where I realised I'd forgotten my tent. etc. God, what else? There have been so many. Loads of Golf GTI Mark 1s and 2s. Triumph Heralds and Vitesses again, Mark 1 and 2 Escorts, Subaru Imprezas. I'm on my third one, one of which is sat outside, the oldest one I've had.
I was going to say, is one of them your grandfather's?
Ah, well, I've got my grandfather's Saab 96 V4.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
So that's been sat for years. My uncle John gave it to me. Because after my granddad died, he had a load of work done on it, then realised it wasn't really for him. Mm. And so he very generously said, right, you have it, but sort of carry on with it. Mm. And I didn't do much with it for a long time because I had the Citroen and various other projects. But it's now sorted, really looking good. and it'll be back on the road in the spring.
Surely that's a car that you won't be able to get rid of.
I will never get rid of it. Well, it scares the life out of me, because if I sit in the back, I remember my granddad's driving, which was appalling. Really, really appalling. And when he died, my gran said, well, I won't miss going in that car, because your granddad, every time he'd drive along and he'd just fiddle with that stick in the middle and make the car jerk. He was changing gear. But yeah, so slightly weird memories of that car, but I do love it.
That's adorable, though.
It is.
We were going to go on to your beginning of your journey of journalism, because you've gone from engineering in radars, is that right?
Yes.
Radars, right.
Wow, top research.
I know, this is my quick 15-minute Google beforehand. No. And to journalism. So was journalism something that you've always thought, you know what, I'm pretty good at writing and I like cars and it seems to be an obvious marriage? Or was it something you kind of not fell into or were forced into, but as you said, just opportunities arose and then you thought, well, I'll give this a go and see how it goes?
I think there were various steps. There was a teacher at school, an English teacher, Mrs. Moriarty, who was just so good and kind of inspired me. Mm. One of those, you know, everybody's got a teacher story, haven't they? There's just that one teacher who did something. That was one step. And I thought, actually, I do like writing things. Then I belonged to the Sporting Escort Owners Club when I had my escorts. And I started writing articles for them and actually thought, oh, this is really cool. Mm. I really like writing about it. And that must have planted a seed. And then at Marconi, all the people in our lab were into cars. There was a TVR 3000M, there was a Chevette HS, there were a few escorts. Loads of people were into really special cars when you look back. And so there were car magazines everywhere. And that was yet another step.
Do you find that you have to read a lot to be a good writer? Or is it something you feel you can just be good at naturally?
I think writing, the sort of flow of writing comes naturally to, should come naturally to people who want to be writers, but you can never read enough. Yeah. And look at different treatments and listen to your own voice, you know, as you're reading your stuff back, kind of listen to it in your head and think, right, am I getting a flow there? And experiment with different ways of writing. And certainly I really enjoyed that side of it.
Do you still read a lot now to make sure, or do you find it so easy now that you don't feel like you need to? Like, I suppose when I'm looking at, I'm always continually inspired by amazing photographers and I don't ever want to just kind of, not give up because I enjoy it as well, but I want to make sure I don't ever kind of slow down or get worse because there are so many incredible photographers out there and just to continue being inspired. So to keep the quality, I suppose, of the Magneto, it must be something you need to keep on top of and make sure you're kind of like scrubbed up on your car words.
yeah, definitely. I mean, reading a lot of magazines, and books as well, fiction and non-fiction. I absolutely love sort of travel books. You know, the classic Ted Simon's Venus Travels, Jupiter's Travels, golly, almost got that wrong. I've just reread that, and that's years old. Mm. And all those kind of books are great. And just the way they tell stories and the way they conjure up images is fantastic. So I love that side. But actually, I don't write anywhere near as much as I used to. And the bit that fascinates me more than anything now is how magazines are put together and how different magazines flow and little tricks they've got for pulling in readers, even to the point of Grazia or something like that, where you've got the 10 events or the big happenings of the week or the month. And then how different paper stocks are used. So really anarchy stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've been doing magazines for a long time and I really love magazines. And it's very frustrating that quite often I will look at a shelf and think, oh, I don't like any of these magazines and I want to like them. I want to spend all my money on them.
As what, things to keep or as bits of art or because you're interested in what they're talking about?
Both.
Okay. It's something I found interesting when you were talking about it, of what you read is almost not similar to what you write, but it ends up being highly inspirational to what you end up putting on paper, because I thought to myself, you know what, I'd really like to get into writing myself. And I don't think I'm too bad, but I'm definitely a photographer. But I thought, you know what, maybe if I could kind of do a bit of both, and that'd be a nice way of going on one shoot and being able to get not twice the amount of money, but, you know, a little bit more. And at the time, I think I was reading The Lord of the Rings books, one of, or yeah, anyway, started to try and write this article about, I can't remember what I was writing about. My word, I bored myself trying to read it because I was like, I'm going into way too much detail here just from simply from thinking, you know, you're suddenly looking, well, I was thinking about how Tolkien would be talking about a blade of grass. And I'm like, nobody's interested in a blade of grass. I've got to be talking about cars here or something. And so it's interesting to see how inspirational, yeah, what you are consuming is going as an output. And so I suppose it's interesting as well on if you want to get, you know, better at videos of car things, then watch great videos. Don't watch crap and then think, how can I be better than that? Watch the great stuff and think, how do they do it so well, I suppose. Mm. But are you inspired by any car magazine? Maybe I shouldn't talk about this. It's being your competitors.
Or you could get into writers that have inspired you who perhaps aren't around anymore or have retired.
Yeah. The classic that everybody mentions is Russell Belgian, isn't it? And Mikey from Road Rat mentioned him.
Yeah.
He was kind of a bit before my time in a way, but I look back and think, oh, yeah, yeah, that's really special. There's an American writer who's still around, and I cannot think of his name, which is typical. But he did a brilliant column for years, and I think it's in Road and Track. And they'll be going to, American friends are going to be screaming at me now because I should know who it is.
What was the article about? I'll see if I can do a quick Google.
I can't even remember. he would always he'd do a column about sort of life in the workshop, really, and just, you know, trying to find the right spanners, and he was really into motorbikes and 60s cars, from what I remember. I'm totally failing there, so I'm very sorry. That's the worst story ever. But he was brilliant. Just the way he was able to talk about things that we could really relate to. Anyone who's into spannering on cars, and you know, in my case, taking them apart and very rarely putting them back together. He kind of got that, the whole psychology of it and all those stupid little things you do. He was brilliant for that, which is utterly pointless for me to say because we don't know who it is.
Do you think is there a key ingredients list to what makes a good story? Whether that's a car review or whether that's just a overview of an event or, you know, something like Pebble Beach, which of course is an event that a lot of people won't necessarily have access to personally, but they love reading about it or they love watching videos and things. What do you find makes a good story?
Oh, so difficult, isn't it? The human side is always fascinating. You obviously want to hear or to read something that you don't necessarily know or didn't necessarily know beforehand. But then sometimes you want to read things that just cement your view and you go, oh yeah, that is why I knew. But I almost didn't know I knew it. And it's told in a really interesting way. It's very difficult to pin it down. Some features just work beautifully. John Simister, sort of current writer, has been around for years, but you read his words and they just flow in the most amazing way.
He's a very lovely man as well.
He is a lovely man, yeah, absolutely. He's so knowledgeable. But if you try and, from a magazine side, an editing side, if you try and cut his words to fit a layout, you can't do it. Because every word leads into the next word and every sentence leads into the next sentence, every paragraph, etc. And it's such an amazing craft. While others, you've got to cut it from 1,500 words to 1,000 words and you go, yep, chop, that's all gone. It sounds really brutal.
Yeah.
But it's because they've just not written it well enough. So I think you have to have that flow. You've got to have some intrigue. You've got to pull people in with something that they can relate to. The Aston Martin Bulldog story on the front cover.
Yeah, because that was the last time that I saw you was on HMS Prince of Wales, wasn't it? Yeah. And I was like, hey, do you want to come on the podcast?
That was then.
So, I mean, yeah, sorry, I put it in there, but how do you talk about, okay, they put a car on a ship. How do we make that an interesting story?
Yeah, that's just bizarre, isn't it, really?
I'm hooked already.
Yeah, exactly. I think the story of the car is fascinating. The fact that it was on a ship was just bonkers anyway. But the whole, when you look back at that story of that car and how you got these engineers sort of with no budget whatsoever, so you got that sort of human side of them doing almost a, you know, not quite in their spare time, but they were going way beyond what they should have been doing to create this crazy car that was Britain's first supercar. And then you've got all the intrigue of it going off to the Middle East and the way it was treated and the new owner blowing the thing up just down the road from Newport Pagnell on his first drive on the M1. Just some really mad stuff goes on. So you need all those human stories. Mm. I don't think there's any point in having, say, a race report where that car went faster and that one went there and blah, blah, blah. You do want to know all the stories behind it.
Yeah, that's exactly as you say there, that human element, isn't it? The idea of you as the reader reading about a car that's completely unobtainable. You know, that Aston Martin Bulldog is a complete, it's one off really, isn't it? It's one of one. So the idea that somebody's bought that once upon a time, it's then blown up on the M1. Everybody reading that can imagine what that must be like. That human element of going, oh God, could you imagine being that guy phoning up the dealership and going, it's broken now.
I don't even know if you would phone up a dealership in that situation. Like, hi, AA, can you please come and get me? Yeah, what's your car? The Aston Martin Bulldog. Yeah. I'm like, it's interesting trying to talk about something that's completely not relatable in terms of, as you said, John, you'll never be able to own that, drive that. If you see it, it'll be cool. So I suppose flipping it around, how do you talk about or make something interesting that's very much not interesting? Like when you do things like car reviews that you're just like, this is not interesting. How do I make this exciting to read?
I've been really, really lucky in that, partly by design, I haven't had to go off and drive a car that I don't really care about. I've driven lots and lots of classic cars and I've driven lots of new cars, but they're always fairly interesting ones. But it is the older stuff that I generally drive, and there's always a story to them and there's always something interesting. You've got all the history of where it's been and what it's done, even if it's done nothing. Why has it done nothing? How come it's been sat in this garden for however long? So there's always something there. I've never had to go and review the latest, I don't know what I'm going to say now, Kia. Sorry, Kia. They're brilliant cars, but how do you write about that? Is that something that somebody like John Simister manages to do, or Clarkson does from a really flippant point of view, but actually very cleverly?
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital.
Yeah, that was the one I was going to refer to. And we've talked about whimsically about Clarkson's writing, or certainly I have, because I'm a big fan of his style. And I think that is a real talent, isn't it? When you can talk about a very, very run-of-the-mill Volvo estate and yet make it a really captivating story. I mean, that in itself is a huge skill. Do you have any cars, either from a car launch you've gone on or one you've been given as a press car, that really stick in your memory? Is one that... Because I occasionally do this as an occasional writer. I'll drive a car and I start mapping out the story as I'm driving, going, oh, this is so good. I know exactly what I'm going to say. And you almost want to get your voice recorder out in your phone and start saying things. Do you have any that really stick in your memory from over the years?
New cars or any car?
Both, yeah.
Oh, so many. And I start writing the opening paragraph in my head.
Yeah.
I always do that. I can't help myself. So many. Shah of Iran's Lamborghini Miura.
Oh, wow.
That was quite cool. A BMW 328, but pre-war, which is almost
beautiful.
Like a...
One of my favourites,
You feel like a fighter pilot driving it. Astonishing thing. It doesn't look anything special. It takes you... You were talking about pre-war cars.
Yeah.
I had no interest in them at all. Mm. But the more you get into cars, the more you think, oh, how did that work?
That's it, yeah.
And you were talking about pre-1910 or something like that. London to Brighton, did it in an old, I think it was a 1904 Wolseley. It's probably one of the greatest motoring experiences ever had. It was, it was.
But what made it so great for you?
It was the atmosphere. It was the sort of challenge of making the thing work and stop.
Oh, were you driving or were you a passenger?
I was driving.
Oh my word!
Yeah, I mean, there was probably nothing scarier than going down a hill in one of those things, and you start at 30 miles an hour and you end up at the bottom of the hill at 40 or 45 miles an hour, and you have no way of doing much about it. But what a phenomenal thing, and everyone's waving, and just a remarkable atmosphere, and really you realize how good the cars are. As you say, they've got horse carriage wheels. They've got tiller steering, some of them. The brakes aren't very good, to say the least. Yeah. But they get you there, and they do all the things that a modern car does. ish.
And I guess there's that sort of route, isn't there, into ultimately this contraption that I'm peddling is ultimately what's led me to then have experiences driving some of the most amazing new cars and supercars and really, really special stuff to this day. So yeah, what about new cars? Are there any launches you can think of where you thought, oh my goodness, that they're really onto something here?
Mm-hmm. Some of the Land Rover are renowned for amazing launches. Mm-hmm. And the last generation Range Rover going through Morocco, and they really push you. You know, I'm not an off-road driver. I've done a few things with Land Rover. Mm. But to go through sand dunes in Morocco and then through the Atlas Mountains and through riverbeds, and you think, all right, nobody's, you know, so many people will be completely unaware of what this vehicle can do.
Yeah.
But what an amazing experience. And the same with Land Rover Discovery. We did something in the States with them, which sounds very privileged, and it was. But it really showed how remarkable that vehicle was. And I'm not a fan of how it looks, but the things it does are incredible.
Yeah, I have to say, I suppose this is what the great thing about being a journalist and photographer is, that we are very lucky in that we get sent out to go and experience these vehicles where they're, you know, wanting to be shown off in their best light. And I was also in Utah with Land Rover for a shoot, and some of the capabilities of some of the cars, I was shocked. I thought, that's not going to get up there. It's almost like a wall. It's a I don't know, over 45 degree wall up, and you just think a rock, and it's just on road tires, and you think, how the hell is that going to get up? And anyway, fascinating what some of them can really do. But I mean, what would be one of the, it's an obvious question, people ask me the same, I'm going to do the same and ask you, but the most exciting, interesting, adventurous, not even necessarily press, no, let's say it was story, like adventure that you've had to do for a story.
I'm trying to think.
There's
now
always something that sticks in your mind, and you think.
Yeah, there usually are. For me, it's little experiences a lot of the time. Norman Dewis, when he was, I think he was awarded an MBE, and he asked me to say, this is a Jaguar test driver, from 50s, 60s, right into the 70s. He asked me to go along with him for the ceremony at Buckingham Palace. Wow. So I went with him to do that. So this isn't the kind of adventure you were envisaging at all.
Yeah, but I like this answer already.
It was such an amazing experience to be there with Norman, and Tony O'Keefe from Jaguar. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of that, we surprised him by taking him to Stirling Moss's house.
Aww.
So he sat there with Stirling Moss and Norman, and they were sat together like two schoolboys. And then Susie was, Sterling's wife, Susie was sort of telling them off because they were coming up with all these stories about these girls. Oh, I remember them. And, you know, Goodwood was the best place for crumpets. Oh, my God. You can't say that. But they were so funny. And they were just, you know, they were both very small men, but such characters.
Yeah.
And I was sat there witnessing this and kind of giggling along with them, thinking, how on earth am I here?
Yeah.
Not what you expected me to ask.
No, but that's a much better
answer. That's brilliant. Had some amazing drives through the canyons in the States with really well-known collector in California, Bruce Mayer, in his Ferrari 250 GT CFAC hot rod. Driving through the canyon roads to the rock store, which is an amazing sort of biker hangout. But I remember reading about it when I was probably 13. And there was a story, and I think it was in Witch Bike or The Biker or something like that. And it really captured my imagination. It was about all these bikers who'd go there, and then they'd go off through the canyons and almost racing through the canyons. And there'd be deaths, there'd be terrible injuries, but they were so dedicated to this rock store. So I went there in a Ferrari with Bruce, who's the nicest man you can possibly imagine. We pulled over halfway to the rock store to take some pics, I think, from what I remember. And a motorbike pulls over, and a guy flips up the front of his crash helmet. It's one of those sort of ones where the whole front comes up.
Yeah.
Hey, Bruce. Hey, David. How are you doing? It's a terrible accent. It's not Welsh. and it was Jay Leno. And it's okay, this is the most mad day ever. And, you know, I'm just this guy from Watford who's somehow landed in this bizarre position of doing these things. So, yeah, that was quite good. And racing, I guess. Racing a little Austin A35. And I was looking at some of the old videos of it last night. Just complete coincidence. And watching a little battle with James Martin, the chef, in his Ford 100E. And we had such a good battle at Goodwood. And I'm thinking, I was driving at the members' meeting. Yeah. It's amazing. I'm not that good a driver, but that was astonishing. So, yeah, those are the kind of things.
Amazing. And on the flip side, are there any less enjoyable, shall we say? I wanted to say disastrous. So you could get onto that subject. But both with, perhaps with cars that you've been on a launch for that you've really been looking forward to, and it's actually been a bit underwhelming, but then also adventures that have gone wrong.
I'm sure there are millions of them.
and your Porsche to Le Mans doesn't count.
Oh yeah,
yeah, no, the forgotten tent
part of it. Yeah,
but I guess the thing is with a disaster adventure, is it's always going to be a good story, isn't it?
Yes. It is.
So whilst you may not look back on that memory and go, okay, that was actually a really difficult thing to do, but it made a good story.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, I think with the sort of new cars and the ones that you hold up as being really special, sometimes they're just maybe a bit anodyne. Mm-hmm. After you've driven Lamborghinis and old Ferraris and things like that, and then you get in a modern supercar or hypercar, and they're phenomenal things.
Yeah.
But are they really the answer? And they just feel, they're not engaging until you're driving them way too fast for the road, which is maybe me and whatever age I'm at. thinking, this is a bit wrong. But they are phenomenal. They're the most incredible feats of engineering. But I think I'd rather cars just came back a step and were a little bit lighter and smaller. Obviously, it's not going anywhere near that kind of way.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I've come away from supercar launches going, it's okay. It's phenomenal, but as far as disasters go, I mean, you obviously racing, sooner or later you can have a race where you do something stupid or you just sit at the side of the track waiting to be rescued for the whole race. And it's always the 45-minute race where you sat there going, oh, this is good. Yeah. But no, I'd say I've had a couple of scary incidents racing that almost put me off. Where I've had the A35s in particular were a bit prone to rolling. So I had one roll in front of me at Brands Hatch. Ooh. And that scared the life out of me because I saw the guy looking at me as I speared towards him on the racing line, and he was upside down, hanging in his harnesses, and I missed him and he was fine and it was all okay. But, you know, I'm not a professional racer.
No.
But other than that, no, life has been very good.
Oh, that's good. Do you, just thinking back to your comment on the driving a supercar that perhaps is just a bit too fast and a bit too complicated for the road, do you have a sweet spot memory for cars? Yeah, I have a very preferred era of cars. Is there one that you look back on and think, that was it, that was the pinnacle, things aren't going to get any better?
It does move around a lot, this. But I would say, if you're in Ferraris, you're probably, I don't know, early 2000s, Ferrari, something like that, or as far as supercars go. Mm-hmm. Since then, again, they've got bigger. They have got much better to be in. But as far as the driving experience goes, I think because the cars are bigger and heavier and you don't really feel what you're doing anymore.
Mm. Yeah.
I think since, early 2000s, I'm going to say.
Yeah.
Can I ask one kind of last question about where you think the future of, let's go with, I'm going to, this very broad question, future of media and cars generally. Do you think that print will always be a thing? Do you think that cars will stay at least exciting to an extent, or classic cars to still be around? Where do you think the future of these things are going to go?
Okay. I think print will stay around in the collector car market for quite a long time, because it is something you'll collect. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've talked about Magneto and making it look really special and making it look different from any other magazine. And I think that's where magazines need to go and where print needs to go. I think in the new car world, do you need a magazine, a print magazine? Maybe not. But if there is going to be one, then it's got to be all about experiences. Don't do it about new launches and don't do it about new models. Do it about amazing experiences in new cars, but don't try and do everything that's being done on the internet, you know, several weeks beforehand. It's pointless. Why do that? As far as cars go, I think there's still an amazing passion for cars. With classic cars, there's a real danger that perception, public perception, will kill them off, where somebody looks at an old car and goes, "Oh, that terrible stinky thing." But I think that's something that we all need to fight and point out that actually it's a very good thing. It's a renewable thing. You know, the emissions aren't as good on a classic car, but they're hardly being used at all.
That's right.
And there's so many skills being kept and so many people employed and so many amazing experiences with old cars and with new special cars that we have to keep that going. But I am at heart as well, it's kind of a tree-hugging hippie, you know. I don't want the world to burn. And I love nature, I love animals. So I don't want to see all those things sacrificed for cars. But I think we have to look very carefully at the way classic cars in particular are represented and modern cars and the way manufacturers, again, I'm going to bang on the weight and the size and the power of them, the fact that you can get a very average Audi just accelerating past you at some phenomenal rate because the guy's just on the paddle shift getting... I find that a bit tedious. And I think it's immoral that manufacturers are doing that and pushing power up higher and higher when they should be making them more efficient but more interesting to drive.
I think that's everything you've just said there is going to be triggering a lot of nodding heads all over the world listening to that because you're so right. Yeah, and this is something we've spoken about both on previous podcasts, both on our radio show as well, where there is this really bad rep that older cars are getting, and it's so unjust because, of course, like you say, the classic cars that most of us have and cherish, they are a weekend car or an evening car or something you get out once in a while. Yes, okay, they might be a little bit worse for the environment in the sense of what they're burning, but ultimately the major part of that car from a carbon offset point of view, if we're getting really geeky here, has already happened because that happens in the build process. And the build process for most classic cars is stratospherically less than building a modern car, and especially when you're factoring in refining batteries, mining batteries, shipping the cars around the world to get built, the processes of how cars are made now and what's used and what materials, it doesn't even compare. So yeah, I always find myself saying very, very similar things to what you've said there, David, in the sense of, no, but hang on a minute, I get this. In fact, I did it with a friend of mine's two doors down next door neighbour who came and moaned about the fact that, oh, you both drive sporty old cars and you shouldn't because it's bad for the environment. But then having delved into the conversation with this lady, she announced that she bought a new car every 2 years. And I was like, come on, you know, think about it. Just think about it. Think about the bigger picture. So I really hope that certainly in this time where the world is seeming to become electrified and as you say, there's this bizarre power battle where everybody feels they need to be 0-60 in under 3 seconds now, even in a Audi A3. It's like, come on, fast cars can be very exciting, but it isn't necessary in all aspects of cars. We don't have to be going for that top speed stuff. It is possible to have a great time in a great car that doesn't need to be 4 tons and have a all singing, all dancing engine that's been built in 4 different corners of the planet. I think, well, this has been a really fascinating conversation. It's been great to hear your insight. What's next for you? Have you got anything that you're really looking forward to for this new year?
Magneto is so young, really. You know, it's only just turning 3 years old. Mm-hmm. So just building that more and more. I think the issue we did with Bulldog was the best one we've done so far. I'm really proud of that.
It was the photos, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. There were some photos of some Bulldog restoration by some Amy Shaw. Like, you
know. I've heard of her.
They were very good.
Very expensive.
Very good, yeah, terrible. So keep building on that, but we do loads of things. That's kind of our flagship, but we also do we're doing a Pebble Beach book for Pebble Beach Concours, official 70th anniversary book. So that will be out early next year. It's already sort of loads of orders have been taken, but we'll actually see it around that point. We do a Concours yearbook. We do a load of motor racing stuff. We're doing starting to do bits for manufacturers as well, which is really interesting.
Oh, cool.
We've just done the first ever magazine for a hypercar manufacturer, which was really good fun. Did it in about 2.5 weeks flat. So there are so many new challenges. And then we've relaunched our website and there's just so much going on. And I find that really exciting. I like the we went on that new challenge thing. That's what it's all about. It's just learning and finding new challenges all the time.
Perfect. And that, let's give that website a plug.
Oh, well, I better remember what it is then. It's magnetomagazine.com.
Perfect. That is brilliant. Thank you so much. It's been, really fascinating insight to hear this, the progression of a world that I think, you know, as I alluded to at the beginning of this conversation, it's one that a lot of people do kind of go, oh, print media, you know, is that still a thing? But it is still a thing. It is very much still a thing. And there is definitely passion in it. And if you are a listener that is at that exciting stage of your life where you're thinking that it might be time for a change or it might be time to think about a career, don't let it put you off. I mean, be aware, you're not going to be a millionaire, but...
You'll drive loads of great cars.
Yeah.
You'll live like a millionaire.
You'll live like a millionaire, yeah.
Some of the time. Then go and have beans on toast.
That's it. That's exactly it. Thank you so much, David. Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Listener, thank you so much. As always, if you would like to engage with the show, you can do that. You can write to us via email, podcast@drivenchat.com. We've also got our new, brand new, just launched website, drivenchat.com, where you can contact us via the website as well. You can also look back on every single previous podcast episode that we've done, as well as some written articles and some videos and other bits and pieces all around the stuff that we do. And of course, approximately 38,000 photographs by our very own Amy Shaw. So there's loads to see. So yes, thank you very much for listening. We look forward to coming back and giving you another podcast in, about a week's time. Bye.
Bye.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Oh, wow. You've made it to the end. The very end. And it's John Markar here again, reminding you that this podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now run its course and has come to an end. To find the new format, search the Driven podcast in your preferred podcast app or head on over to the website driven.site to find some quick and easy links through to the new episodes in the new formats on your preferred apps. Thanks. Bye.